They do, huh? I bet you're scared.
Oh, do you now?
You're a lass. Lasses are always scared.
We are not.
You are too. And you've got a funny name. Jill's not a real name. It's a bondwoman's name.
So what?
What do you mean, so what? It's the worst thing, being one of the bond folk. You shouldn't be wearing those brigger either.
I am not a bondwoman, and my dad gave me these brigger.
Your dad's a silver dagger, and they're all scum.
Jill hauled back and hit him in the face as hard as she could. Abrin shrieked and hit back, but she dodged and punched him on the ear. With a howl, he leapt for her and knocked her down, but she shoved her elbow into his stomach until he let go. They wrestled, kicking, punching and writhing, until Jill heard Cullen and Glenn yelling at them to stop. Suddenly, Cullen grabbed Jill by the shoulders and pulled her off the helpless Abrin.
Now, what's all this?
He said silver daggers were all scum, so I hit him.
Abrin sat up, snivelling and wiping his bloody nose. Cullen gave Jill a broad grin, then hastily looked stern again.
Now here, Abrin.
Glynn grabbed the boy.
That's a nasty way to treat a guest. If you don't learn courtesy, how can you serve a great lord some day?
Berating him all the while, Glynn hauled Abrin off into the broch. Cullen began brushing the dirt off Jill's clothes.
By the asses of the gods, my sweet, how did you learn to fight like that?
Back in Boba, you know. All the children always called me a bastard, and they said I had a bondwoman's name, and so I'd hit them. And then I learned how to win.
Well, so you did. Ye gods, you're Cullen of Caermore's daughter, sure enough.
For the rest of the day, Jill and Abrin scrupulously avoided each other. But on the morrow morning, Abrin came up to her. He looked at the ground near her feet and kicked a lump of dirt with the toe of his clog.
I'm sorry I said your da was scum, and my da said you can have any name you want to, and you can wear brigger if you want to, and I'm sorry about all of it. My thanks. And I'm sorry I made your nose bleed. I didn't mean to hit you that hard.
Abrin looked up, grinning.
Want to play warrior? I've got two wooden swords.
For the next couple of days, life went on quietly in Tyrin Breith's dun. In the mornings, Cullen and two of the riders rode out to patrol the oak wood. In the afternoons, the Tyrin and the other two riders relieved them. Jill helped Abrin with his tasks round the dun, which left them plenty of time to play at swords or with Abrin's leather ball. Jill's only problem was Abrin's mother, who was sure that Jill should be learning needlework instead of playing outside. Jill grew quite clever at avoiding her. At meals, the warband ate at one table in the great hall, while the Tyrin and Glynn's family ate at another. Once the counsellor retired to his chambers, however, Breith would come drink with the riders. He always talked about the feud, which he knew year by year, events that had happened long before he was born, down to the most recent insult. Finally, after about a week of this pleasant routine, Breith hurried over to the warband's table on evening with his pale eyes gleaming. He had news. One of the servants had been to the local village and had overheard gossip about Enid's plans.
The base-born pusboil! He's claiming that since the swine rights are his, he can send in his swine any time he likes, summer or fall. They say he's planning on sending a few pigs in under armed guard.
Except for Cullen, the warband began cursing and slamming their tankards on the table.
And I say he won't set one trotter in my woods,
Breith went on.
From now on, the full warband's going to ride on patrol.
The warband cheered.
Your Grace,
Cullen broke in.
If I may speak. By all means, I value your experience in the field highly.
My thanks, Your Grace.
Well, here, the woods are a bit long for only one patrol. The warband might be down at one end while Enid's making his entry at the other. We'd best split into two patrols and ride a crisscross route. We can use a page and a servant to send messages and such like.
Well spoken. We'll do just that and take Abrin along with us.
Can I go, Your Grace?
Jill burst out.
I've got my own pony.
Jill, hush!
Cullen snapped.
Now there's a lass with her father's spirit, Breyth said with a grin. You may come indeed.
Since Breyth was the Tyrin and he the silver dagger, Cullen could say nothing more, but he gave Jill a good slap later when he got her alone. After 2 days of riding with the patrol, Jill regretted pressing the issue because she found herself bored. With Cullen and 2 riders, she trotted up to one end of the wood, then turned and trotted back to meet the Tyrin and the rest of the warband, back and forth, from dawn to dusk. Her one solace was that she got to carry a beautiful silver horn slung over her shoulder on a leather strap. Finally, on the 3rd day, when they'd been out on patrol no more than an hour, Jill heard a strange noise a good ways from them on the edge of the woods. She slowed her pony and fell back to listen. A clattering, grunting, snorfling sound.
"Da!"
Jill called out.
"I hear pigs and horses!"
The 3 men swung their horses around and rode back.
"So it is." Cullen drew his sword with a flourish. "Ride for the Tyrin. We'll hold them off."
As she galloped, Jill blew her horn. At last she heard Abrin's horn close at hand. Tyrin Breyth burst out of the trees to meet her.
"Your Grace!"
Jill screamed.
"They're here!"
She turned her pony and raced back ahead of them for fear of missing a single thing. As she burst out of the forest, she could hear the swine clearly, grunting their way along. There was a path crossing a wide green meadow, and Cullen and the others were sitting on their horses to block it. Down across the meadow came a strange procession. At its head rode a lord, who had to be Enid, carrying a green blazoned shield with a gold boss. 7 riders, also armed and ready, rode behind him. At the rear came a herd of 10 swine, accompanied by 2 terrified peasants poking the pigs with sticks to keep them moving. Tyrin Breyth and his men galloped into position beside Cullen and the others. When Breyth drew his sword, the other men did the same, screaming out insults to Lord Enid, whose men screamed right back. Cullen yelled at Jill and Abrin to stay out of the way, then sat quietly on his horse, his sword resting on his saddle peak.
"Lord Enid's a swine himself,"
Abrin said,
"bringing all his men just so he can outnumber us."
"He is, but we're not truly outnumbered. My da's worth at least 3 men.
Slowly the procession came on. The swine kept breaking ranks, grunting and complaining, forcing the men to wait while the peasants rounded them up again. At last, Lord Enid pulled his horse up about 10 feet in front of Tyrin Breyth. While the 2 lords glared at each other, the swine milled round. Even from her distance, Jill could smell the big grey boars, with a roach of dark hair down their backs and shiny tusks curling out of their snouts.
"So," Enid called out, "would you block me from my lawful rights, Breyth?"
"Those rights are not yours to take," Breyth said.
"They are. I will not be blocked this way and dishonored."
The swine grunted loudly as if they were cheering him on. Cullen urged his horse up closer and bowed in his saddle to the lords.
"Your Grace, my lord, both of you," Cullen said. "Can't you see what a pretty picture we make with the swine to watch our tournament?"
"Hold your tongue, silver dagger," Enid snapped. "I won't be mocked by a dishonored man."
"I meant no mockery, my lord," Cullen said. "If I may speak, would you claim that you yourself have the right to ride into the grove?"
Breyth grinned at Enid's sullen silence.
"Tell me, my lord," Cullen went on, "if these swine weren't at stake, would you dishonor the High King's judgment on these woods?"
"Never would I dishonor the High King," Enid said, "but my swine."
With a whoop, Cullen kicked his horse to a gallop, dodged around Enid and his men, and rode straight for the herd of swine. Yelling a war cry at the top of his lungs, he swung around with the flat of his sword. The swine and their tenders fled in terror, pig and peasant alike, grunting and shrieking, as they raced across the meadow toward home. Both warbands were laughing too hard at the sight to give chase, much less battle. Only Enid was furious, yelling at his men to stop laughing and do something. Finally, Cullen left the pigs and jogged back.
"Good, my lord,"
Cullen called out.
Your swine no longer desire passage here.
Enid spurred his horse forward and swung at Cullen. Cullen parried, catching the blade on his own and leaning slightly to one side. Enid tumbled out of his saddle and onto the ground. In his warband, yells exploded. Chasing swine was one thing, dishonoring their lord quite another. The seven men swung their horses round and charged straight for Cullen, with Braith's men in close pursuit. Jill clutched her saddle peak and screamed. Dar was out there all alone. She saw Enid scrambling back onto his horse just as the warbands closed round them. The horses were plunging and kicking, the men swinging and cursing. Dust rose up as thick as smoke. The men were dodging and parrying more than they were honestly trying to strike. Jill wondered if any of them had ever been in battle before. The flash of blades, the horses rearing, men pushing and swinging and yelling. It swirled in a terrifying dance, the clot of horses and men turning slowly round and round, the flashing swords keeping time. At last, Jill sighted Cullen, moving his horse round the edge of the melee. Cullen stayed silent, his face impassive, as if he found the battle tedious. Then he began to strike, and he wasn't dodging like the others. He cut hard, shoved his way into the mob, slashed round, and struck over and over as he made a set course for Lord Enid. Ahead of him, Enid's warband fell back. One man reeled in the saddle with blood running down his face. Cullen went on swinging with a bloodied blade and led Braith's men through like a wedge. He had almost reached Enid's side when one rider shoved his horse in between. For a moment swords flashed and swung, then the rider screamed and fell over his horse's neck into the mob. Cullen tossed his head, but his face showed nothing at all. With a shout of surrender, Enid turned his horse and fled, his warband close behind him. One riderless horse galloped with them. Braith and his men chased them, but slowly, and only down to the edge of the meadow. Cullen stayed behind, dismounted, then knelt by the body of the rider. Without thinking, Jill dismounted and raced over to him.
"Da, are you all right?"
"Get away!"
Cullen rose and slapped her across the face.
"Get away, Jill!"
Although Jill ran back, it was already too late. She'd seen what Cullen didn't want her to see. The rider, lying face down in the grass with a pool of blood spreading from his throat and soaking into his soft blonde hair. Blood smelled warm, sticky, and unexpectedly sweet. Abrin ran to meet her.
"Did you see?"
His face was dead white. Jill fell to her knees and began to vomit, kept it up until her stomach was sore. Abrin grabbed her shoulders when she was done and helped her stand. She felt as cold as if it were snowing. They walked back to the two ponies and sat down to watch the warband come back, laughing and crowing at the victory. Jill was so tired that she closed her eyes, but she could see the dead man like a picture, the blood spreading round him. Hastily she opened her eyes again. Cullen left the warband and walked over.
"I told you to stay away," he said.
"I just forgot. I couldn't think."
"I suppose not. What's that on your mouth? Did you throw up?"
Jill wiped her face on her sleeve. He was still her Dar, her handsome, wonderful Dar, but she had just seen him kill a man. When he laid his hand on her shoulder, she flinched.
"I'm not going to slap you," Cullen said, misunderstanding. "I threw up myself the first time I saw a man killed. Ah, by the hells, another man dead over pig food. I hope our drivelling fool ends this here."
"Enid, you mean?" Abrin said.
"Him too."
The warband took the dead man's body back to the dun for the tyrant to send to Enid in honourable return. Since the dead man's horse had fled in the rout, Abrin had to give up his pony and ride behind Cullen. When the riders tied the corpse to the saddle, Jill made herself look at it, flopping like her rag doll, not a man any more at all. She felt sicker than before. When they reached the dun, Glynn and the servants ran out to meet them. In the confusion, Jill slipped away, going around behind the broch and finding a quiet spot to sit in the shade of the ruined wall. She knew that Abrin would run to his mother, and she envied him bitterly. She'd been there for some time before Cullen found her. When he sat down next to her on the ground, she could hardly look at him.
"The Herald's riding out now to take that poor lad home. This corpse should end the thing. The honour of Breiv's piss-poor warband has been avenged, and Enid's had all the gas scared out of both ends of him."
Jill looked at Cullen's hands, resting on his thighs. Without his heavy gauntlets, they looked like his hands again, the ones that gave her food and combed her hair and patted her on the shoulder. She wondered why she'd thought that they would have changed.
"He's killed lots of men," she thought. "That's why he has all that glory."
"Still feel sick?" Cullen said.
"I don't. I didn't think blood would smell like that."
"Well, it does, and it runs like that too. Why do you think I didn't want you riding with us?"
"Did you know someone would get killed?"
"I was hoping I could stop it, but I was ready for it. I always am, because I have to be. I truly did think those lads would break sooner than they did, you see. But there was one young wolf in the pack of rabbits. Poor bastard. That's what he gets for his honour."
"Da, are you sorry for him?"
"I am. I'll tell you something, my sweet, that no other man in Deverry would admit. I am sorry for every man I ever killed, somewhere deep in my heart. But it was his weird, and there's nothing a man can do about his own weird, much less someone else's. Some day my own weird will take me, and I've no doubt it'll be the same one I've brought to many a man. It's like a bargain with the gods. Every warrior makes it. Do you understand?"
"Sort of. Your life for theirs, you mean?"
"Just that. There's nothing else a man can do."
Jill began to feel better. Thinking of it as weird made it seem clean again.
"It's the only honour left to me, my bargain with my weird," Cullen went on. "I told you once, never dishonour yourself. If ever you're tempted to do the slightest bit of a dishonourable thing, you remember your father and what one dishonour brought him. The long road and shame in the eyes of every honest man."
"But wasn't it your weird to have the dagger?"
"It wasn't."
Cullen allowed himself a brief smile.
"A man can't make his weird better, but it's in his hands to make it worse."
"Da," Jill said, "do the gods make a man's weird?"
"They don't. Weird rules the gods too. They can't turn aside a man's weird, no matter how much he prays and carries on. Do you remember the story of Gwyndic, back in the dawn time? The goddess Epona tried to save his life, but his weird was upon him. She sent a spear at the cursed Hermes, but Gwyndic turned and took the spear in his own side."
"So he did, and he didn't even complain. But that lad you killed screamed."
"I heard him."
Cullen's face went dead calm, just as it had in the battle.
"But don't hold it against him. I don't."
Jill thought for a moment, then leaned against his shoulder. Cullen put his arm around her and pulled her close. He was still her father, and all she had in the world. Close to nightfall, the Herald returned. After conferring with the Tyrin and the Herald, Councillor Glynn sought Cullen out.
"Lord Enid will sue for peace in the morning," Glynn said, "and Tyrin Breith will grant it." "Thanks be to the gods of our people. Here, Jill and I will be riding on in the morning."
That night, Cullen let Jill sleep in the same bunk with him. She cuddled up to his broad back and tried to think of things other than the battle, but she dreamt about it. All over again, she ran up to Cullen and saw the dead rider, but when she looked up, Cullen was gone, and Ava stood there, just as Jill had always imagined her, tall and strong, with golden braids coiled about her head and a long spear in her hand. She was carrying a shield with the device of the moon in its dark phase. Jill knew that she couldn't see the moon if it was dark, but in the dream she could. Since she refused to disgrace herself in front of Ava, Jill made herself look at the rider. As she watched, his whole body turned to blood and soaked into the earth until there was naught but grass growing thick and green. When she looked up, Ava was smiling at her, and the moon on her shield was full. Jill woke and listened to the comfortable sound of Cullen snoring beside her. She thought over the dream to make sure that she remembered all of it. Although she wasn't sure why, she knew it was very important. 2. For 7 long years, ever since the Lark Omen down on the Eldith coast, Nevin had been wandering the kingdom and searching for the child who held his weird in her soul. For all the power of Dwayoma, it has limits, and no Dwayoma master can ever scry out a person whom he hasn't seen at least once in the flesh. Trusting the luck that's more than luck, Nevin had taken his riding horse and his pack mule, laden with herbs and medicines, and lived by tending the ills of the poor folk as he travelled endlessly from place to place. Now, with another summer coming to an end, he was on the road to Cantray, a city in the northeast corner of the kingdom. He had a good friend there, Lydin the apothecary, with whom he could spend the winter in comfort. The Cantray road ran through endless grassy hills, stippled with white birches in the little valleys. One particularly fine afternoon, he was travelling slowly, letting his horse pick its own pace, while the mule plodded behind. He was lost in thought that was close to being a trance, musing over the woman he would always think of as Bronwyn, even though she was now a child with another name. All at once he was startled out of his reverie by the clatter and pounding of a mounted warband trotting straight downhill toward him, about 20 men with the silver dragon of Aberwyn blazon on the shield slung beside each saddle. They rode behind a young lad. One of the men screamed at Nevin to get off the road and out of the way. Nevin hurriedly swung his horse's head to the right, but the lad rose up in his stirrups and yelled at the warband to halt. Swearing aloud, with a clatter of hooves and the jingle of tack, the men did as they were told. As Nevin rode toward them, he realized with a sense of absolute amazement that the young lord at their head was ordering them to get off the road and let the aged herbman pass by. The lad, some 10 summers old, wore the blue, silver and green plaid of Aberwyn. He was easily one of the most beautiful children Nevin had ever seen, with raven-dark wavy hair, large cornflower blue eyes, and perfect features, his mouth so soft and well-formed that it was almost girlish. Nevin stopped his horse beside him and made him a bow from the saddle.
"My humble thanks, my lord," Nevin said. "You honour me too highly."
"Any man with hair as white as yours, good sir, deserves some courtesy."
The young lord shot his men a haughty glance.
"It's easier for us to handle our horses than it must be for you."
"Well, true spoken. Would his lordship honour me by telling me his name?"
"Lord Rodri Maelwyth of Aberwyn."
The lad gave him a charming smile.
"And I'll wager you wonder what Eldith men are doing so far from home."
"I did have a thought that way."
"Well, I was a page at my uncle's, Evemir of Cantray, but my father sent part of his warband to fetch me home. My brother Adry just got killed."
"That saddens my heart, my lord."
"It saddens mine, too."
Lord Rodri looked at the reins in his hands and blinked back tears.
"I loved Adry. He wasn't like Rhys. Rhys is my eldest brother, I mean, and he can be a true hound."
He looked back up with a sheepish smile.
"I shouldn't be saying that to a stranger."
"Truly, my lord, you shouldn't."
When Nevin looked into the boy's dark blue eyes, he nearly swore aloud. For a moment he looked into another pair of eyes, looked through them into the soul of a man whose weird was inextricably bound with his and Bronwyn's. Then the vision left him.
"And will his lordship be staying at the Aberwyn court?" Nevin said.
"Probably. I guess my father wants me home because I'm the second heir now."
"It would doubtless be wise of him, my lord. I may see his lordship in Aberwyn. I often travel to Elith to gather herbs."
Nevin bowed again, a gesture that Rodri acknowledged with a lordly wave of his hand, then clucked to his horse and rode on by. At the top of the hill, he turned in his saddle to watch the warband trotting off in a cloud of dust.
"Luck and twice luck," Nevin told himself. "Thanks be to the Lords of Weird."
That night, Nevin found shelter in a shabby little inn beside the road. He got himself a stool by the hearth, an old tired man from the look of him, nodding over a tankard of ale and staring into the flames. None of the other patrons spoke to him, not even the rowdy riders of the local lord. He shut the noise out of his mind and concentrated on his scrying. In the hearth, flames played over logs and embers glowed, forming a backdrop for his imaging. When Nevin thought of young Lord Rodri, he saw the lad wrapped in his plaid cloak by a campfire and eating a chunk of bread while his men sat nearby. Nevin smiled, then banished the vision. At last, he'd found an excellent clue. Always before, in all those other lives they'd shared, he'd found Bronwyn linked to this man's soul. Sooner or later, if Nevin didn't find her first, she and Rodri would be drawn together, and now Nevin knew where to find Rodri.
"And what was his name, then?" Nevin asked himself. "Blaine. Truly, that was it. All those years ago."
In the tavern, men were laughing, jesting over ale, wagering on the dice. Nevin felt utterly cut off from them and the normal life they represented. He was also very tired that night, and the memories came to him unbidden, as bitter as always. All he truly wanted to do was die and forget, but death was forbidden to him.
"A long time ago now indeed," he thought.
But those days held the beginning of it all. Deveri, 643. If you write in the sand with a stick, soon the waves and wind will wash away the words. Such are the mistakes of ordinary men. If you cut words into stone, they remain forever. A man who claims the Dwayoma becomes a chisel. All his misdeeds are graved into the very flank of time itself. The Secret Book of Cadwallon the Druid. 1. The storm came at sunset, hard rain and wind that made the spring forest tremble. By dawn, the roof of the hut was leaking, a thin but steady trickle in the corner that grooved the dirt floor before it escaped under the wall. Regar stood with his hands on his hips and watched it run.
"The way out won't be so easy for you."
"I know," the prince said, "but I'll be back here before the Beltane feast, I swear it."
Regar smiled as if he doubted it. He picked a couple of big logs off the woodpile in the corner and laid them on the small stone hearth. When he waved his hands over the logs, flames sprang up and flared along the bark. The prince let out his breath with a little hiss.
"You will have to get over your infatuation with these tricks," Regar said. "The true Dwayoma lies deeper than that."
"So you've said, but I can't lie and say I've already gotten over it."
"True enough. You're a good lad in your way, Galrion."
As supple as a cat, Regar stretched his back, regarding the prince with shrewd eyes. Regar looked like an old peasant, short, barrel-chested, dressed in a dirty pair of brown brigger and a patched plain shirt, with a bit of rope round his waist for want of a proper belt. His grey hair hung cropped and untidy, his grey moustaches always needed a trim. At times, when he wasn't watching his thoughts, Prince Galrion wondered why he was so impressed with this man that he'd follow his orders blindly.
"It's the Dwayoma," he told himself. "Who needs wealth when you've got the Dwayoma?"
"Have you been thinking about this betrothed of yours?"
Regar said.
"I have. I'll do what you told me."
"You should be doing it because you understand the reasons, not just following my commands like a hunting dog."
"Of course. But you're sure? I can bring her with me."
"If she'll come. Marry her first, then bring her along."
Regar glanced around the skew-walled hut.
"It's not a palace, but we'll build her a better home by winter."
"But what if she doesn't want to come?"
"If she chooses freely, then release her."
Regar paused for effect.
"Freely, mind you."
"But if she... if we... have a child?"
"What of it?"
Regar caught his sulky glance and stared him down.
"A vow is a vow, lad, and you swore one to her. If this were the usual arranged marriage, it would be different, but you sought her and won her. A man who can't keep his word is of no use to the Dwayoma, none."
"Very well, then. I'll ride to Bronwyn before I go and lay the matter before my father."
"Good. She deserves the news first."
Wrapped in his cloak of scarlet and white plaid, Gowrion mounted his black horse and rode off through the unbroken forest of ancient oaks. In a little while, he would return as a poverty-stricken exile to study the Dwioma, if he could fight himself free of his old life. Gowrion was the third of the four sons of Adoric, High King of Aldaveri. With two healthy heirs ahead of him and one behind in reserve, he was a disposable young man, encouraged all his life to spoil himself with his beloved horses and hunting so that he'd present no coveting threat to his eldest brother's claim on the throne. He saw no reason why he shouldn't ride away from court, out of the way for good, and no longer a drain on the royal treasury. Yet he doubted if his father would see things so simply. Adoric II, the ruler of a recent and unstable dynasty, seldom saw anything simply. And there was the matter of Bronwyn, the lord's daughter whom Gowrion had won over many another suitor. Only a few months ago he'd loved her so much that the weight of their betrothal time seemed an unjust torment. Now he saw her as a potential nuisance. Rhaegar admitted that Gowrion would make slower progress with his studies if he had a wife and children than if he were alone. There were duties a man had to fulfill if he were married, Rhaegar always said, but after 22 years of having every one of his royal whims satisfied, Gowrion was in no mood to hear talk of duty. He was used to having exactly what he wanted, and he had never wanted anything as much as he wanted Dwioma power. He hungered after it and thirsted for it. Or, as he thought about it during his damp ride through the forest, wanting the Dwioma was a lust, a burning inside him. Once he'd thought he lusted for Bronwyn, but now a new lust had driven that passion out. To delve into secret lore, to learn and master the secret ways of the universe, to stand in control of forces and powers that few people even knew existed, against rewards such as those, mere love looked as valuable as a pebble lying in the dirt. The prince's ride was a short one. One of the many things bemusing Gowrion these days was the way that Rhaegar had chosen to settle so close to the Falcon clan and Bronwyn, where Gowrion could stumble across him and Dwioma both. "If he'd been but 10 miles farther south, I'd never have found him," Gowrion thought.
"Truly, Dwioma must be my weird."
It occurred to him that his love for Bronwyn was probably just a tool in the hands of his weird, drawing him to Rhaegar. Rhaegar himself, of course, had already hinted that there were other, important reasons that Gowrion had fallen in love with her. Gowrion's heart sank as he remembered those hints. Just as the drizzle died into a cloudy noon, he rode out of the woods into cleared fields and saw the Falcon Dun rising at the crest of an artificial hill built for defence in this flat country. Round the base of this motte ran a pair of earthworks and ditches. At the top stood a wooden palisade with iron-bound gates. Inside stood the squat stone broch and a clutter of round wooden sheds and huts for the servants. As Gowrion led his horse in, the muddy ward came alive with servants, a groom running to take his horse, a page to take his saddlebags, the chamberlain to greet and escort him ceremoniously inside. As the aged chamberlain struggled with the heavy door, the prince glanced up. Over the lintel hung a severed head, blackened, weather-shrunken, with rain dripping from the remains of a blonde beard. Bronwyn's father, Dwen, held to the ways of the Dawntime warriors. No matter how much the priests reproached him, no matter how often his daughter begged him to have it taken down, Dwen stubbornly kept his trophy up, the head of his worst enemy from a long blood feud. The great hall was warm, smoky, and light-shot from the fires burning at either side. Up by the bigger hearth, Dwen and Geraint were drinking in their carved chairs, with a pack of staghounds sleeping in the straw by their feet. Geraint rose to greet Gowrion, but Dwen stayed seated, sodden in his chair, a florid-faced man whose rheumy eyes glanced up through folds of skin. It was hard to believe that in his youth he must have looked much like his son, this tall, blond warrior, square-shouldered, with an arrogant toss to his head.
"Good morrow, my liege," Geraint said. "My sister's in her chamber. I'll send a page for her."
"My thanks."
Gowrion bowed to Dwen.
"My lord?"
"Sit down, lad, and have some ale."
Dwen wheezed as he spoke, then coughed and nearly choked. Gowrion felt a cold shudder, a bristling of hairs along the back of his neck as if a draught had touched him. Although Dwen had been ill for years and never seemed to sicken further, Gowrion knew with a sharp stab of Dweoma that soon he would die. A page brought Gowrion ale, a welcome distraction from Dwen's illness. When Gowrion raised the tankard to Geraint in friendly salute, Geraint forced out a smile that was the barest twitch of his mouth. It didn't take Dweoma to know that Geraint hated him. Gowrion merely wondered why. The door across the great hall opened, and Bronwyn came in with her maidservant in attendance. A tall lass, willow slender in a dark green dress, she wore her long blonde hair caught back in a simple clasp, as befitted an unmarried woman. Her eyes were as deep and blue as a winter river. The most beautiful lass in all Deveri, men called her, with a face that was dowry enough for any man in his right mind. Drawn by the love he'd thought he'd cast out, Gowrion rose to greet her. He took both her hands in his.
"I didn't think to see you soon, my prince," Bronwyn said. "This gladdens my heart."
"And it gladdens mine, my lady."
Gowrion seated her in his chair, then took a footstool from the maidservant and put it down to keep Bronwyn's feet off the damp straw-strewn floor. He perched on the edge of the stool and smiled up at her while she laughed, as merry as sunlight in the dark room.
"Will His Highness honour me by riding with me to the hunt tomorrow?" Geraint said.
"I won't, by your leave," Gowrion said. "I have things to discuss with my lady."
"She's not your lady yet."
Geraint turned on his heel and stalked out of the hall. When he slammed the door shut behind him, Dwen roused from his doze, glanced round, then fell back asleep.
"Oh, here, Gwenny," Gowrion whispered. "I hope I haven't offended your brother by not riding with him on the morrow."
"Oh, Gero's in such a mood these days I can't talk a word of sense into him about anything. Here, my love, don't you think it's time he married? He's put it off awfully late. He'll be 20 at the turning of the summer."
"True enough."
Gowrion was remembering his Dweoma warning of Dwen's coming death.
"He'll be the Falcon some day, after all. Is there any woman he favours?"
"Not truly. You men can be such beasts."
Bronwyn giggled, hiding her mouth behind her hand.
"But, well, Gero rides to hunt with Lord Blaine of the Boar, and his sister's just absolutely mad for Gero. I've been trying to speak well of her to him, but he doesn't much listen."
"I've seen the Lady Isola at court. She's a lovely lass, but naught compared to you, of course."
The compliment brought another giggle and a blush. At times, Bronwyn was a helpless little thing, unlike the women at the court, who were trained as partners in rulership. Once, Gowrion had looked forward to the chance to prune and form his wife's character. Now, he found himself thinking that she was going to absorb much of his time.
"Do you know what Isola told me?" Bronwyn said. "She said that Blaine's jealous of you."
"Indeed. That would be a serious matter if it's true."
"Why?"
"Ye gods, think. The Boar Rampant was involved in many a plot against the last dynasty. A lover's rivalry is a political matter when one of the rivals is a prince."
"Truly. My apologies."
She turned so woebegone over his snap that Gowrion patted her hand. She bloomed instantly and bent down to allow him to kiss her cheek. Circumstances conspired to keep the prince from having his necessary talk with his betrothed. All evening, Geraint kept them sullen company. On the bright and sunny morrow, Bronwyn settled her father outside in the ward, then sat down beside him with her needlework. Much to Gowrion's annoyance, the old man stayed wide awake. Finally, when Geraint stopped by on his way to hunt, Gowrion decided that since he might soon be Geraint's elder brother, he might as well put that authority to good use.
"Here, Gero," Gowrion said. "I'll ride a little way with you after all."
"Well and good."
Geraint shot him a glance that said the exact opposite.
"Page, run and saddle the prince's horse."
Preceded by a pack of hounds and followed by a pair of servants, Gowrion and Geraint rode to the woods. The Falcon clan lay lonely on the edge of the kingdom. To the north, the clan's farmlands stretched out until they met those of the Boar, their only near neighbour. To the east and south was nothing but unclaimed land, meadow and primeval forest. It occurred to Gowrion that Bronwyn was doubtless looking forward to the splendid life at court that he could no longer give her.
"Well, young brother," Gowrion said at last, "there's something I wanted to talk with you about. My lady Bronwyn tells me that you've won the favour of Isolde of the Boar. She'd make any man a fine wife."
Geraint stared straight ahead at the road.
"You're a man now," Gowrion said. "It's time you married for your clan's sake. The head of a clan needs heirs."
"True spoken. I know my duty to my clan."
"Well then, Blaine's your sworn friend. It would be a fine match."
"Did Gwenny put you up to this talk?"
"She did."
Geraint glanced his way with bitter eyes.
"My sister knows her duty to the clan as well."
As they rode on, Geraint was lost in thought, his hand on his sword hilt. Gowrion wondered how this proud man was going to take it when Gowrion swept his sister off to a hut in the forest instead of the palace. The prince was vexed all over again at his stupidity in getting himself betrothed just as he had found the Dwayoma.
"Does Gwenny think Isolde would have me?" Geraint said.
"She does. She'd bring a fine dowry, too."
They rode in silence for some minutes while Geraint considered, his mouth working this way and that, as if the thought of marrying a rich, pretty wife pained him. Finally he shrugged, as if throwing off a weight from his shoulders.
"Grant me a boon, elder brother," Geraint said. "Will you ride to Blaine with me as my second in the betrothal?"
"Gladly. Shall we ride soon?"
"Why not? The soonest done, the best."
That evening, dinner marked a celebration. While the Falcon's domain stretched broad and prosperous, there had been few sons born to the clan over the past generation. If Geraint should die without an heir, the clan would die with him, its lands reverting back to the High King for reassignment. Every now and then, Gowrion noticed Geraint looking at the blade of his table dagger, where a falcon mark was graved, the clan's symbol, and his whole life, his duty and power. After Bronwyn escorted her father from the table, Gowrion had a chance at a private word with Geraint.
"My lady Bronwyn was teasing me the other night," Gowrion said, "saying Blaine's jealous of me. Is that just a maid's chatter?"
"It's true enough."
Geraint made the admission unwillingly.
"But she's dwelling on the thing to please her vanity. Blaine will forget her soon enough. Men in our position marry where we have to, not to please ourselves."
Gowrion felt a cold touch like a hand down his back, the Dwayoma warning of danger. Never had that warning failed to be true, not since he'd felt it first as a little lad, climbing a tree and knowing, without knowing how he knew, that the branch was about to break under him. The dun of the Boar clan lay a full day's ride to the north. A stone broch rose 3 floors above a cobbled ward and proper wooden round houses for the important servants. Off to one side were the stables that also doubled as a barracks for the warband of 12 men. Lord Blaine's great hall was fully 40 feet across with a dressed stone floor. 2 tapestries hung on either side of the honour hearth, and fine furniture stood round in profusion. As he walked in, Gowrion had the thought that Bronwyn would be far happier in that dun than she would be in the wilderness. Blaine himself greeted them and took them to the table of honour. He was a slender man, sandy-haired, good-looking in a rather bland way, with blue eyes that always seemed to be smiling at a jest.
"Good morrow, my prince," Blaine said. "What brings me the honour of having you in my hall?" "My brother and I have come to beg an enormous favour. My brother has decided that it's time for him to marry."
"Oh, have you now?"
Blaine shot Geraint a smile.
"A wise decision with no heirs for your clan."
"If it's so wise," Geraint snapped, "why haven't you made one like it?"
Blaine went as stiff as a stag who sees the hunting pack.
"I have 2 brothers.
The moment hung there. Geraint stared into the hearth. Blaine stared at the prince. Gowrion hardly knew where to look.
"Ah, curse it," Blaine snapped.
"Can't we dispense with all this mincing around? Gero, do you want my sister or not?"
"I do. And my apologies."
When Gowrion let his eyes meet Blaine's, he saw only a man who wanted to be his friend. Against great odds, perhaps, but he did. Yet the Dwayoma warning slid down his back like snow. In his role as a courting man's second, Gowrion went to the woman's hall, a half-round of a room above the great hall. On the floor were bardic carpets in the clan colours of blue, green and gold. Silver candlesticks stood on an elaborately carved table. In a cushioned chair, Rother, dowager of the clan, sat by the windows, while Isola perched on a footstool at her mother's side. All around them lay wisps of wool from the spinning that must have been tidied away at the prince's approach. Rother was a stout woman with deep-set grey eyes and a firm but pleasant little smile. Gowrion had always liked her when they'd met at court. Isola was a pretty lass of 16, all slender and golden with large, eager eyes.
"I come as a supplicant, my lady."
Gowrion knelt before the two women.
"Lord Geraint of the Falcon would have the Lady Isola marry him."
When Isola caught her breath with a gasp, Rother shot her a sharp look.
"This is a grave matter," Rother pronounced. "My daughter and I must consider this carefully."
"But mother!"
"My lady," Gowrion said to Rother, "do you have any objections to Lord Geraint?"
"None, but I have my objections to my daughter acting like a starving puppy grabbing a bone." "You may tell Geraint that we are considering the matter, but my son may start discussing the dowry if he wants, just in case Isola agrees." Blaine was expansive about the dowry. Isola, of course, had been filling her dower chest for years with embroidered coverlets, sets of dresses, and the embroidered shirt her husband would wear at his wedding. To go with it, Blaine offered 10 geldings, 5 white cows, and a palfrey for Isola.
"Gero," Gowrion said. "That's splendidly generous."
"What?" Geraint looked up with a start.
"Oh, whatever you think best."
Yet that evening, Geraint acted the perfect suitor, happy to have his lady within his reach at last. At table, he and Isola shared a trencher, and Geraint cut her tidbits of meat and fed her with his fingers as if they were already married, a gesture that made Isola beam with happiness. Gowrion and Rother, who were seated next to each other, found themselves watching the couple, and occasionally turning to each other to share a thoughtful glance. Since the bard was singing, and Blaine laughing with his brother Camlan, Gowrion and Rother could whisper in private.
"Tell me," Rother said, "do you think Geraint will come to love my daughter some day?"
"He'd be a fool not to."
"Who knows what you men will do?"
Gowrion broke a slice of bread in half and offered her one portion.
"Is this better than no bread at all?"
"You're a wise one for someone so young, my prince."
Rother accepted the bread. "Does that come from living at court?"
"It does, because if you want to live to be an old prince, you'd best keep your eyes on every little wave of everyone's hand and your ears on every word they speak."
"So I've been telling your little Gwenny. Life at court is going to be difficult for her at first. She's lucky to have a man like you to watch over her interests."
Gowrion felt a stab of guilt.
"I'm as bad as Gero," he thought. "I'll have to offer Gwenny at least a half a piece of bread, unless I find her a man who'd give her the whole loaf."
Courtesy demanded that Gowrion and Geraint take the boar's hospitality for several days. The more Gowrion saw of Blaine, the more he liked him. A cultured man as well as a generous one, with a fine ear for the songs of his bard, and a proper knowledge of the traditional tales and lore. Even more, Gowrion came to admire Rother, who carried out her dowager role with perfect tact. She would make Bronwyn a splendid mother-in-law. At times, Gowrion remembered Rhaegar's insistence that she choose freely, but he doubted if Gwenny, poor little innocent Gwenny, was capable of making such an important decision on her own. Late on the second day, the prince escorted the dowager to the garden for a stroll. The spring sun lay warm on the glossy leaves and the first shy buds of the roses.
"I'm much impressed with your son," Gowrion said. "He should feel more at home at my court."
"My thanks, my prince." Rother hesitated, wondering, no doubt, how to turn this unexpected honour to her son's advantage.
"I'm most grateful that you favour him."
"There's only one slight thing. You'll forgive my bluntness, and I'll swear an honest answer will do Blaine no harm. Just how much does he hold Gwenny against me?"
"My son knows his duty to the throne, no matter where his heart lies."
"Never did I think otherwise. I was merely wondering how fine his honour might be in matters of the heart. Let me be blunt again.
Suppose Bronwyn was no longer betrothed to me. Would he spurn her off as a cast-off woman?
Briefly, Rother stared, as open-mouthed as a farm lass, before she recovered her polished reserve. I think my prince is troubled at heart to speak this way.
He is, but he'll beg you never to ask why. He'll tell you this much. He's troubled by the life ahead of Bronwyn. Flatterers at court will come around her like flies to spilled mead.
Not just flies, my prince. Wasps come to spilled mead, and Gwenny is very beautiful.
She is.
Suddenly torn, Gowrion wondered if he could truly let her go.
And I loved her once.
Once and not now? Rother raised a doubting eyebrow. Gowrion walked a little ways ahead, letting her catch up with him in the shade of the linden tree. He caught a low branch and stripped the leaves off a twig to rub them between his fingers before he let them fall.
My prince is deeply troubled, Rother said.
The prince's troubles are his own, my lady. But you never answered me. Would Blaine marry Gwenny if he could?
Oh, in a moment, my poor lad. I swear he's been ensorcelled by Gwenny's blue eyes.
He put off marrying until she came of age, and then, well...
The prince stepped in, giving the boar another reason to chafe under the High King's rule. How would the boar take it if his mother hinted that the prince was yielding to a prior claim?
I've no doubt he'd honour the prince always. Smiling, Gowrion made her a deep bow. It could work out well, he told himself. Yet, at the thought of Bronwyn lying in another man's arms, his heart flared rage. When the day came for Prince Gowrion to ride back to court, Geraint rode a few miles with him, simply because he was expected to. The prince smiled and chatted until Geraint wanted to murder him and leave his body in a ditch by the road. At last they reached the turning, and Geraint sat on his horse and watched the prince's scarlet and white plaid cloak disappear into the distance. 3 more weeks, only 3 more weeks, and the prince would return from Dun Deveri to take Bronwyn away. With her, Geraint's heart would go breaking. When he rode back to the dun, Geraint found Bronwyn sitting outside in the sun and sewing. He gave his horse to Brithu, his page, and sat down at her feet like a dog. Her golden hair shone in the sun like fine-spun thread, wisping around the soft skin of her cheeks. When she smiled at him, Geraint felt stabbed to the heart.
"What are you sewing?" Geraint said. "Summat for your dower chest."
"It's not, but a shirt for you. The last one I'll ever make. But don't worry, Isola does splendid needlework. I'll wager that your wedding shirt is ever so much nicer than my poor Gowrion's."
Geraint rose to his feet, hesitated, then sat again, trapped in his old torment, that his beautiful sister, the one beautiful thing in his world, would turn him into something ugly and unclean, despised by the gods and men alike, if ever they knew of his secret fault. All at once she cried out. He jumped to his feet before he knew what he was doing.
"I just pricked my finger on the beastly needle," Bronwyn said, grinning at him. "Don't look so alarmed, Gero. But oh, here, I've gotten a drop of blood on your shirt. Blast it."
The little red smear lay in the midst of red interlaced bands of spirals.
"No one's ever going to notice it," Geraint said.
"As long as it's not a bad omen, you're right enough. Doubtless you'll get more gore on it than this. You do get so filthy when you hunt, Gero."
"I won't wear it hunting until it starts to wear out. It'll be my best shirt, the last one you ever sewed for me."
Geraint caught her hand and kissed the drop of blood away. Late that night, Geraint went out to the dark, silent ward and paced restlessly back and forth. In the moonlight, he could see the severed head of old Samaric gazing down at him with empty eye sockets. Once every dun and warrior's home would have been graced with such trophies, but some years past, the priests had had visions stating that taking heads had come to displease Great Bell. Of all the lords round about, Dwen was the last to defy the change. Geraint remembered the day when the priests came to implore him to take the trophy down. A tiny lad then, Geraint hid behind his mother's skirts as Dwen refused, roaring with laughter, saying that if the gods truly wanted it down, they'd make it rot soon enough. Chanting a ritual curse, the priests left defeated.
"I'm the curse," Geraint said to Samaric. "I'm the curse the gods sent to our clan."
Geraint sat down on the ground and wept. The days passed slowly, long days of torment, until Geraint fled his sister's presence and rode to Blaine on the pretense of seeing his new betrothed. He and Blaine were more than friends. The year before, when they'd ridden to war together, they'd sworn an oath that they would fight at each other's side until both were dead or both victorious, and they had sealed that oath with drops of their own blood. In his blood-sworn friend's soothing company, Geraint spent a pleasant pair of days, drinking at Blaine's hearth, hunting out in his forest preserve, or riding aimlessly across his lands with the warband behind them. Geraint envied Blaine for having a warband. He was determined to get one of his own. The 10 horses that he'd receive in Isola's dowry would be a splendid start, and soon Vronwyn's royal marriage would bring wealth to the Falcon, a Lewith, a blood price of sorts, but too small a compensation for the losing of her. On the third day, late in the afternoon, Geraint and Blaine rode out alone. Enjoying each other's silent company, they ambled through the fields until they reached a low rise that overlooked meadowlands. Tended by a pair of boys and a dog, Blaine's herd of white cattle with rusty red ears grazed below.
"Let's hope there's no war this summer," Blaine said.
"What? What are you doing? Turning into an old woman?"
"I'm not ready to start sucking eggs yet, but I'll tell you, Summit, I'd never tell any other man. There are times when I wish I'd been born a bard, singing about wars instead of fighting them."
Thinking it a jest, Geraint started to laugh, then stopped at the quiet seriousness in Blaine's eyes. All the way home he puzzled over it, remembering Blaine's calm courage in battle, and wondering how any man would want to be a bard rather than a warrior. They returned to the dun at sunset. As he dismounted, Geraint saw Brithu running out of the broch.
"My lord," the boy panted out, "I just got here. Your father's dying."
"Take the best horse in my stable," Blaine said. "Break him if you have to."
When he rode out, Geraint left the page behind so that he could make good speed. He galloped through the twilight, alternately trotted and galloped even when dark fell, though the row lay treacherous in the pale moonlight. Not for one moment did it occur to him that he might be thrown. All he could think of was his father, dying without a last sight of his son, and of Bronwyn, tending the dying alone. Whenever the horse stumbled, he would let it walk to rest, then spur it on again. At last he reached the small village on the edge of his lands. He banged on the tavern door until the tavern man came hurrying down in his nightshirt with a candle lantern in his hand.
"Can you change my horse?" Geraint said.
"Lady Branwen had the grey brought here to wait for you."
The grey was the fastest horse in the Falcon's stable. Geraint switched saddle and bridle, flung the tavern man a coin, then kicked the grey to a gallop, plunging out of the candlelight and into the night-shrouded road. At last he saw the dun rising, the palisade dark against the starry sky. He spurred one last burst of speed out of the grey and galloped through the open gates. As he dismounted, the chamberlain ran out of the broch.
"He still lives," Drath called out. "I'll tend the horse."
Geraint ran up the spiral staircase and down the hall to his father's chamber. Propped up on pillows, Dwen was lying in bed, his face grey, his mouth slack as he fought for every breath. Bronwyn sat beside him and clutched his hand in both of hers.
"He's home, Dar," she said. "Gero's here."
As Geraint walked over, Dwen raised his head and searched for him with rheumy eyes. Dwen tried to speak, then coughed, spitting up a slime of blood-tinged phlegm, slipping and glistening as his head fell back. He was dead. Geraint wiped the spittle off his father's mouth with the edge of the blanket, then closed his eyes and folded his arms across his chest. The chamberlain came in, glanced at the bed, then flung himself down to kneel at Geraint's feet, at the feet of the new Falcon, head of the clan, and its only hope.
"My lord, I'd best send a page to the king straight away. We've got to catch the wedding party before it leaves."
"So we do. Get him on the way at dawn."
It would take 3 days to get the message to Dun Daveri that Bronwyn's wedding would have to wait for a time of mourning. All at once, as he looked at his father's face, Geraint turned sick with self-loathing. He would have given anything to stop that marriage. Anything but this. He threw his head back and keened, cry after wordless cry, as if he could drive his thoughts away with the sound. In the morning, the priests of Bel came from the temple to preside over the burial. Under their direction, Bronwyn and her serving maid washed the body, dressed it in Dwen's best court clothes, and laid it on a litter. While the servants dug the grave, Geraint groomed and saddled his father's best horse. The procession assembled out in